Thank you very much. Thank you, President DeGioia, for that wonderful introduction. Thank you, Happy, for that great start to this session. I'd like to thank the Board of Trustees and say how pleased I am to be here at Georgetown University's Distinguished School of Foreign Service. I just have to recognize my friend Andrew Natsios, who's sitting in the front row. Even if he did leave us to come to Georgetown, he said he was doing it because this is an institution that he loves dearly. You've got a fine man, and you're going to have a fine professor in Andrew Natsios. Thank you for your service to the country. I want to thank members of the Diplomatic Corps who are here and several members of the administration. I also want you to know that I do know a good deal about Georgetown, and it is because this is a fine school of foreign service for which we all owe a debt of gratitude for the people that you have trained, for the people who have come to us in government, for the people from whom I have learned as an academic. This is also a fine university in general, a university that is well known for its dedication to learning, but also its dedication to values and to social justice. And it's also a university that is recovering its heritage in basketball, and I look very much forward to this year. Almost a year ago today, in his second inaugural address, President Bush laid out a vision that now leads America into the world. It is the policy of the United States, the President said, to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. To achieve this bold mission, America needs equally bold diplomacy. A diplomacy that not only reports about the world as it is, but seeks to change the world itself. I and others have called this mission transformational diplomacy. And today, I want to explain what it is in principle and how we are advancing it in practice. We are living in an extraordinary time, one in which centuries of international precedent are being overturned. The prospect of violent conflict among great powers is more remote than ever. States are increasingly competing and cooperating in peace, not preparing for war. Peoples in China and India, in South Africa and Indonesia and Brazil, are lifting their countries into new prominence. Reform, democratic reform, has begun and is spreading in the Middle East. And the United States is working with our many partners, particularly our partners who share our values in Europe and in Asia and in other parts of the world, to build a true form of global stability, a balance of power that favors freedom. At the same time, other challenges have assumed a new urgency. Since its creation more than 350 years ago, the modern state system has rested on the concept of sovereignty. It was always assumed that every state could control and direct the threats emerging from its territory. It was also assumed that weak and poorly governed states were merely a burden to their people, or at most an international humanitarian concern, but never a true security threat. Today, however, these old assumptions no longer hold. Technology is collapsing the distance that once clearly separated right here from over there. And the greatest threats now emerge more within states than between them. The fundamental character of regimes now matters more than the international distribution of power. In this world, it is impossible to draw neat, clear lines between our security interests, our development efforts, and our democratic ideals. American diplomacy must integrate and advance all of these goals together. So I would define the objective of transformational diplomacy this way: to work with our many partners around the world to build and sustain democratic, well-governed states that will respond to the needs of their people and conduct themselves responsibly in the international system. Let me be clear. Transformational diplomacy is rooted in partnership, not in paternalism, in doing things with people, not for them. We seek to use America's diplomatic power to help foreign citizens better their own lives and to build their own nations and to transform their own futures. In extraordinary times like those of today, when the very terrain of history is shifting beneath our feet, we must transform old diplomatic institutions to serve new diplomatic purposes. This kind of challenge is sweeping and difficult, but it is not unprecedented. America has done this kind of work before. In the aftermath of World War II, as the Cold War hardened into place, we turned our diplomatic focus to Europe and parts of Asia. We hired new people, we taught them new languages, we gave them new training. We partnered with old adversaries in Germany and Japan and helped them to rebuild their countries. Our diplomacy was instrumental in transforming devastated countries into thriving democratic allies, allies who joined with us for decades in the struggle to defend freedom from communism. With the end of the Cold War, America again rose to new challenges. We opened 14 new embassies in the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, and we repositioned over 100 of our diplomats to staff them. Our efforts helped newly liberated peoples to transform the character of their countries, and now many of them, too, have become partners in liberty and freedom, members of NATO, members of the European Union. Something unthought of just a few years ago. And during the last decade, we finally realized the historic dream of the 20th century, therefore, a vision of a Europe whole and free and at peace. In the past 5 years, it was my friend and predecessor, Colin Powell, who led the men and women of American diplomacy into the 21st century. He modernized the State Department's technology and transformed dozens of our facilities abroad. Most importantly, Secretary Powell invested in our people. He created over 2,000 new positions and hired thousands of new employees and trained them all to be diplomatic leaders of tomorrow. Now, today, to advance transformational diplomacy all around the world, we in the State Department must again answer a new calling of our time. We must begin to lay the diplomatic foundations to secure a future of freedom for all people. Like the great changes of the past, the new efforts we undertake today will not be completed quickly. Transforming our diplomacy and transforming the State Department is the work of a generation, but it is urgent work that must begin. To advance transformational diplomacy, we are and we must change our diplomatic posture. In the 21st century, emerging nations like India and China and Brazil and Egypt and Indonesia and South Africa are increasingly shaping the course of history. At the same time, the new front lines of our diplomacy are appearing more clearly in transitional countries like Africa and of Latin America and of the Middle East. Our current global posture does not really reflect that fact. For instance, we have nearly the same number of State Department personnel in Germany, a country of 82 million people, that we have in India, a country of 1 billion people. It is clear today that America must begin to reposition our diplomatic forces around the world. So over the next few years, the United States will begin to shift several hundred of our diplomatic positions to new critical posts for the 21st century. We will begin this year with a down payment, moving 100 positions from Europe and, yes, from here in Washington, D.C., to countries like China and India and Nigeria and Lebanon, where additional staffing will make an essential difference. We are making these changes by shifting existing resources to meet our new priorities. But we are also eager to work more closely with Congress to enhance our global strategy with new resources and new positions. We will also put new emphasis on our regional and transnational strategies. In the 21st century, geographic regions are growing ever more integrated economically, politically, and culturally. This creates new opportunities, but it also presents new challenges, especially from transnational threats like terrorism and weapons proliferation and drug smuggling and trafficking in persons and disease. Building regional partnerships is one foundation today of our counterterrorism strategy. We are empowering countries that have the will to fight terror but need help with the means. And we are joining with key regional countries like Indonesia and Nigeria and Morocco and Pakistan, working together not only to take the fight to the enemy but also to combat the ideology of hatred that uses terror as a weapon. We will use a regional approach to tackle disease as well. Rather than station many experts in every embassy, we will now deploy small, agile, transnational networks of our own diplomats. These rapid response teams will monitor and combat the spread of pandemics across entire continents. We are adopting a more regional strategy in our public diplomacy as well. In the Middle East, for example, as you well know, a vast majority of people get their news from a regional media network like Al Jazeera, not from a local newspaper. So our diplomats must tell America's story, not just in translated op-eds, but live, on TV, in Arabic, for a regional audience. To make this happen, we are creating a regional public diplomacy center. We are forward deploying our best Arabic-speaking diplomats, and we are broadly coordinating our public diplomacy strategy, both for the region and from the region. Our third goal is to localize our diplomatic posture. Transformational diplomacy requires us to move our diplomatic presence out of foreign capitals and to spread it more widely across countries. We must work on the front lines of domestic reform as well as in the back rooms of foreign ministries. There are nearly 200 cities worldwide with over 1 million people in which the United States has no formal diplomatic presence. This is where the action is today, and this is where we must be. To reach citizens in bustling new population centers, we cannot always build new consulates beyond a nation's capital. A newer, more economical idea is what we call an American presence post. This idea is simple. One of our best diplomats moves outside the embassy to live and work and represent America in an emerging community of change. We currently operate American presence posts in places like Egypt and Indonesia, and we are eager to expand both the size and the scope of this new approach. Perhaps the newest and most cost-effective way to adopt a more local posture is through a virtual presence post. Here, one or more of our young officers creates and manages an internet site that is focused on key population centers. This digital meeting room enables foreign citizens, young people most of all, to engage online with American diplomats who could be hundreds of miles away. This is a great way to connect with millions of new people across Europe and Asia and Latin America. In today's world, our diplomats will not only work in different places, they will work in different communities, and they will serve in different kinds of conditions, like reconstruction and stabilization missions, where they must partner more directly with the military. So to advance transformational diplomacy, we are empowering our diplomats to work more jointly with our men and women in uniform. Over the past 15 years, as violent state failure has become a greater global threat, our military has borne a disproportionate share of post-conflict responsibilities because we have not had the standing civilian capability to play our part fully. This was true in Somalia and Haiti and Bosnia and Kosovo, and it is still partially true in Iraq and Afghanistan. These experiences have shown us the need to enhance our ability to work more effectively at the critical intersections of diplomacy, democracy promotion, economic reconstruction, and military security. That is why President Bush created within the State Department the Office of Reconstruction and Stabilization. Recently, President Bush broadened the authority and mandate for this office, and Congress authorized the Pentagon to transfer up to $100 million to state in the event of a post-conflict operation, funds that would empower our reconstruction and stabilization efforts. We have an expansive vision for this new office, and let there be no doubt, we are committed to realizing it. Should a state fail in the future, we want the men and the women of this office to be able to spring into action quickly. We will look to them to partner immediately with our military, with other federal agencies, and with our international allies. And eventually, we envision this office assembling and deploying the kinds of civilians who are essential in post-conflict operations, police officers and judges and electricians and engineers, bankers and economists and legal experts and election monitors. Our Reconstruction and Stabilization Office must be able to help a failed state to exercise responsible sovereignty and to prevent its territory from becoming a source of global instability, as Afghanistan was in 2001. The diplomacy of the 21st century requires better jointness, too, between our soldiers and our civilians, and we are taking additional steps to achieve it. We've for decades had positions in our Foreign Service called political advisors to military forces, affectionately called POLADs in our business. We station these diplomats where the world of diplomacy intersects the world of military force. But increasingly, this intersection is seen in the dusty streets of Fallujah or the tsunami-wrecked coasts of Indonesia. I want America's diplomats to eagerly seek out assignments working side by side with our men and women in uniform, whether it is in disaster relief in Pakistan or in stabilization missions in Liberia or fighting the illegal drug trade in Latin America. Finally, to advance transformational diplomacy, we are preparing our people with new expertise and challenging them with new expectations. I've been Secretary of State for almost exactly 1 year now. And in that time, I have become more convinced than ever that we have the finest diplomatic service in the world. I've seen the noble spirit of that service, a service that defines the men and women of our Foreign Service and Civil Service and our Foreign Service nationals, many of whom are serving in dangerous places far away from their families. I see in them the desire and the ability to adapt to a changing world and to our changing diplomatic mission. More and more often, over the course of this new century, we will ask the men and women of the State Department to be active in the field. We will need them to engage with private citizens in emerging regional centers, not just with government officials in their nation's capitals. We must train record numbers of people to master difficult languages like Arabic and Chinese and Farsi and Urdu. In addition to advance in their careers, our Foreign Service officers must now serve in what we call hardship posts. These are challenging jobs in critical countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and Sudan and Angola, countries where we're working with foreign citizens in difficult conditions to maintain security and fight poverty and make democratic reforms. To succeed in these kinds of posts, we will train our diplomats not only as expert analysts of policy, but as first-rate administrators of programs, capable of helping foreign citizens to strengthen the rule of law, to start businesses, to improve health, and to reform education. Ladies and gentlemen, President Bush has outlined the historic calling of our time. We on the right side of freedom's divide have a responsibility to help all people who find themselves on the wrong side of that divide. The men and women of American diplomacy are being summoned to advance an exciting new mission. But there is one other great asset that America will bring to this challenge. Now, in a day and a time when difference is still a license to kill, America stands as a tremendous example of what can happen when people of diverse backgrounds, ethnic groups, religions, all call themselves American. Because it does not matter whether you are Italian-American or African-American or Korean-American. It does not matter whether you are Muslim or Presbyterian or Jewish or Catholic. What matters is that you are American and you are devoted to an ideal and to a set of beliefs that unites us. Ladies and gentlemen, in order for America to fully play its role in the world, it must send out into the world a diplomatic force, a diplomatic core that reflects that great diversity. It cannot be that the last three secretaries of state, the daughter of European immigrants, the son of Jamaican immigrants, and a daughter of the American segregated South would be more diverse than the Foreign Service with which they work. And so I want to make a special appeal to each and every one of you. It's exciting to be a diplomat these days because it is not just about reporting on countries, it's not just influencing governments, it's being a part of changing people's lives, whether in our AIDS programs abroad, or in our efforts to educate girls in Afghanistan, or to help with extremism in the Middle East with good partners like Pakistan and Jordan. Imagine the excitement of the people who are going to work in Liberia now with the first woman president on the African continent to try and build a Liberia where people can reach their dreams and their future. But we cannot do it without America's best and brightest. And America's best and brightest come in all colors, they come in all religions, they come in all heritages. Our Foreign Service has got to be that way too. I sit in an office when I meet with foreign secretaries and foreign ministers from around the world. That is a grand office that looks like it's actually out of the 19th century, although it was actually built in 1947, but that's very American too. And there's a portrait of Thomas Jefferson that looks directly at me when I'm speaking to those foreign ministers. And I wonder sometimes, what would Mr. Jefferson have thought? What would he have thought about America's reach and influence in the world? What would he have thought about America's pursuit of the democratic enterprise on behalf of the peoples of the world? What would he have thought that my ancestors, who were three-fifths of a man in his constitution, would produce a Secretary of State who would carry out that mission? Ladies and gentlemen, America has come a long way. And America stands as a symbol, but also a reality, for all of those who have a long way to go, that democracy is hard and democracy takes time, but democracy is always worth it. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'd like to take a few questions now, if we can do that. Here, right here in front, this young man right there. Yes.
Thank you for coming, Madam Secretary.
Yes.
My name is Patrick Schmidt. I just had a quick question for you. You stated, I believe a week ago, that you believe the African Union was dangerously underfunded in their mission in Darfur. And I was very encouraged and excited when you made some public comments asking for the money from Congress to support that African Union. I was then discouraged to find out that you never made a formal request to Congress. So I was wondering why you didn't make a formal request, and if you can commit or will look into making a formal request to Congress for one of the early supplemental bills.
Well, in fact, I wrote letters to key members of Congress to try and to get the $50 million and made phone calls to the same. And it is very important that we get that $50 million. And yes, I think if there is a supplemental, which the administration has not yet decided on, I'm quite certain that we will be asking for help for Sudan. The United States has been very active on three fronts in Sudan. The first is that we've tried to deal with the humanitarian situation, to try and keep people from dying, to try to keep people from suffering. Andrew and his people at USAID have done a fine job in mobilizing non-government organizations to do that. And so we've worked very hard on that front, and we've had some success. Secondly, we're working very hard on the diplomatic front, because since we have, and it sometimes gets lost, since we have the Comprehensive Peace Agreement between the North and the South, ending a decades-old civil war in which millions of people died, we have potentially a model on which we can think about a resolution between the central government in Sudan and the Darfur region. And so we're working very hard on that in the Abuja talks. Finally, as you mentioned, we've been very supportive of the African Union mission there. I personally went to NATO to suggest that NATO provide logistical and planning support. I think NATO will want to look at what more it might be able to do. The challenge now is that the African Union force, I think, has had great success in the places that it's able to deploy in diminishing the violence. But it faces two challenges. One is that it's a big territory. It's the size of Texas. And so 7,000 forces can't cover the territory as a whole. And we're going to have to find a way to enhance the capability, which is one reason that the United States is working with others for a UN peacekeeping mission to oversee or to help the African Union force. The second problem is that Western Darfur, has become more dangerous because of the situation in Chad and border crossings there. So we recognize the difficulties. We're trying very hard to accelerate our efforts on the security front, on the humanitarian front. Ultimately, there has to be a political solution. But when I was out in Darfur several months ago, it's very clear that political solution is really where we need to put more effort. Because if these people are ever going to leave these camps, they have to have a stable government to go home to. Yes. Yes, right here.
Rice, my name is Peter Lasso, and I had the privilege of living in Russia for over 8 years, and I'm troubled at the prospects of Russia's democracy, for example, with President Putin's removal of Russians' right to elect their own governors. And as a Russian expert, I was wondering, what do you think is the future of Russian democracy, and what should the U.S. role be in fostering that democracy?
Well, thank you for that very good question. Obviously, it is extremely important. If we're going to have the kind of relationship that everybody had once envisioned with Russia, that is one fully integrated into the international organizations, fully integrated into democratic institutions, that Russia return to a more democratic path than it is on now. I want to be very clear. It isn't the Soviet Union. You know this place. This Russian government is not the Soviet government. And sometimes people overstate this to say things have gone all the way back. They have not gone all the way back. And one of the issues is how to help ensure personal freedoms, how to help ensure that civil society can continue to operate, which was one reason that we were concerned about the NGO law that was just signed into law by President Putin. I think our role is really twofold. First of all, to continue to try to work with those in Russia who from below are pressuring for a democratic path for Russia, and that means non-governmental organizations, it means university people, it means all of the Russians who themselves want a more democratic future. The second part of this is to continue, though, to keep open for Russia a path toward a democratic West. I believe, for instance, that the work that we do in the Russian NATO Council is very important, that it's a contact point. The work that we do in the OSCE is very important. The G8, where Russia holds the chair, I think it's extremely important that Russia understand that certain responsibilities come with, and certain obligations and certain expectations with being the chair of an organization that is avowedly of industrialized democracies. And so if you're going to be a part of the G8, you'd better be an industrialized democracy, or people are going to have a lot of questions when they show up for the G8 session. So I think we can work on two courses. We can work to continue to stimulate change from within, working with Russian partners. It's for Russians to do. We can try and help. And secondly, I do think we have to keep open the links to a democratic West. Let's see. Right here in front. You're next.
Thank you, Secretary Rice. I'm Raymond Tanter, political science in the government.
How are
department.
You, Ray? Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Madam Secretary, congratulations on holding the permanent five members of the Security Council together on Iran. That's the good news. The bad news is that it seems as if Tehran is using negotiations as a means of continuing with enrichment or breaking the seals at Natanz, breaking the seals at Isfahan, and violating the terms of its agreement with the European Three concerning reprocessing. There's wild speculation about military action as a result of the fact that diplomacy seems to be stymied. Meanwhile, you have a situation where the Iranian opposition, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, is on the foreign terrorist organizations list of the Department of State. And I believe that these are the pro-democratic forces with which we should be working in the West.
Thank you. First of all, let me say I've known Professor Tanter for a long time. We go back to our early days as baby professors, which we won't say how long ago that was. Iran is a very difficult problem. You're right. I think we have a good deal of coherence in the view of the major powers about the fact that Iran stepped over a line when it broke the seals and threatened to begin enrichment and reprocessing. Nobody wants Iran to have that capability. The Iranians want to make this about their rights. This is not about their rights. It's about the ability of the international system to trust them with capabilities and technologies that could lead to a nuclear weapon. And they have a history with the IAEA of not disclosing, of covering their activities, and so no one does trust them with those technologies. Now, in terms of the internal situation in Iran, we've always said that this is not just an issue for us of the nuclear program, although that is its most dangerous manifestation. But this is also a state sponsor of terror. It's a state that is supportive of Hezbollah, which causes difficulties in Lebanon, of Palestinian rejectionists, which make it hard for Abu Mazen to seek the two-state solution with Israel that he seeks. And of course, Iran, unlike so many countries in the region, has been going backwards in terms of its development at home. This is a place that is where you have a population which is outward-looking, which wants to be a part of the international system, which wants democracy and reform, and where the unelected mullahs have done nothing but take more and more power away from the marginally elected institutions that exist in Iran. Now, I won't even speak to the language of the current Iranian president. I mean, Ahmadinejad has given us all a focal point to say if anyone ever thought that this was a state that was behaving in a normal fashion, his statements are so out of bounds, I think that has taken that veneer away. The question is, then, how do you make it possible for there to be change in Iran? And we are trying to work with, through the Congress has made available some funding that we are trying to work as to the degree we can with non-governmental organizations. We try to broadcast in Iran. Iranians go back and forth. This is not a population that is closed off to information. But we do have a problem with MEK. It is a terrorist organization. It has was engaged in killings which actually ended up in the deaths of Americans. That situation has not changed. But we do hope that by standing with the Iranian people, by making clear that the United States believes that the Iranian people deserve a better future and deserve an elected future, that the international community can begin to rally around that cause, because Iran is simply 180 degrees out of step with the rest of the trends in the Middle East. right here in the green sweater. This young lady right here.
Thank you. My name is Shawnee Sambet. I'm a senior in the School of Foreign Service, and I really enjoyed your comments. In fact, I was thinking of going to the bookstore and getting the study guide for the Foreign Service exam. So
good.
But I was really happy to hear in your speech when you're talking about transformational diplomacy that it means that the United States has to work in partnership with countries, working with people, not for people. But then towards the end of your speech, I noticed you were talking about right and wrong. And I was wondering, when we're engaging international actors saying that they're wrong, how is that a true partnership?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you do have to work with people, and we particularly have good working relationships with people who share our values. We have a whole host of countries around the world who are committed to the democratic enterprise, who do believe that the governed ought to have to give their consent, that you don't just rule by a decree, who do believe in women's rights, all of the things that I think are core truths. But you have to be willing to say that they're core truths. It is simply never right that women are subservient. It's simply never right that people have no say in who will govern them. It's simply never right that people have no freedom to worship as a matter of conscience, or not to worship at all. If you're relativist about right and wrong, then you can't lead. Now, you can have policy differences about how best to extend women's rights in the Middle East. You can have policy differences about how best to support democracy in Russia. Those are policy differences. But if America, of all places, doesn't speak for those who are oppressed, if America doesn't speak for the basic human dignities that come with democracy, if America doesn't speak for what the president has called the non-negotiable demands of human dignity, no one will. Throughout the period of the Cold War, I remember how much people in Eastern Europe just wanted to get their hands on something American, or somehow wanted to be able to hear Voice of America, because Voice of America told the truth, or Radio Free Europe, or Radio Free Liberty, because they told the truth. And after the Cold War, as the Cold War was winding down, and you would talk to people, even people who had been a part of the power structure in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe, they would say to you, you know, We waited to make sure that somebody was listening. We wanted not to be abandoned to the dark corners where nobody cared. And so you have to speak with a clarity about what is right and what is wrong. And when you speak with that clarity, I think people do rally to that. You know, I've said to my European friends on many occasions, and we've had a hard time in Iraq. It's hard. It's really difficult. It's difficult for people who've solved their differences, their entire existence, by fighting and by coercion and by repression and by violence. It's really hard for them to find a way to resolve their differences by politics instead and by compromise. It's really hard in Afghanistan, where you still have terrorists who will blow up innocent children at a moment's notice. It's really hard to go to a place like Jordan. I see the ambassador here, and see this hotel where this wedding party, of all things, was blown up by a suicide bomber. It's hard to see the difficulties that the Palestinian people live with every day. It's really hard. But it's been hard before for countries that made it. And you know, if people had given up on Europe in 1942, we wouldn't be standing here today talking about a community of democratic states in Europe. If people had given up on Japan, we would not be standing here today talking about sharing democratic values with Japan. So we've done this before. And it's only when you lose will, or you lose your sense of what is right, that you lose the capacity to have the kind of optimism in the face of the difficulties and the dangers that led our forefathers to deliver Europe and Japan and places like that to a democratic future. And we now, with them, with Europe, with Japan, with others, owe that same kind of commitment to people who are still struggling. Yes.
Thank you very much for coming in. Your program of transformational diplomacy sounds like it could be very fruitful. And I had an obstacle in mind that I thought maybe you could address. In the fall of 2002, the European Union brought a lawsuit that was very detailed to the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District in New York, where they accused a U.S. tobacco company of sanctions busting in Iraq, which brought millions of dollars into the Hussein family, and also of having money laundering and so forth with various terrorist organizations and with organized crime in South America and in the Baltics. And the judges decided in the following spring that this case could be prosecuted under U.S. legislation, including the Patriot Act. However, they would not do so because to do so would be to decide U.S. foreign policy, and they had no indication from Congress or from the administration that it was in the interest of U.S. foreign policy to do so. And I was wondering if you thought that perhaps now it would be in the interest of U.S. foreign policy to convict U.S. corporations that violate such legislation abroad. Thank you.
Well, I can assure you that we don't stand in the way of federal prosecutions of American entities. We don't do that. We have, as you know, a system of an independent judiciary and an independent executive branch. And in fact, I stay very far away from anything that the independent judiciary is doing. I want to speak for a second on something that you mentioned, though, that takes it in a slightly different direction, which is the situation with Saddam Hussein and the sanctions busting that took place in the oil for food and so forth. There, I do think that we learned a very important lesson, which is that if you're going to have a sanctions regime of that kind, that you really need not just controls on it, but oversight of it. And one of the problems that happened with the Oil for Food program is that there was really insufficient authority, insufficient centering of responsibility for what was going on with that program. I think everybody would agree with that, and that's how we had the situation that we did. It is one reason that we are so focused on the need for reform in the United Nations. You may have heard about the debate that is going on reform in the United Nations, and something like the Oil for Food shows that unless you have responsible authority, and in defense of the Secretariat, it has not had the kind of authority that it needs to really manage the affairs of the United Nations. This and budgetary responsibility and the capability to really use assets well is why we've had the kind of reform effort that we had there. And I think that the Oil for Food scandal showed how difficult it is to manage a regime of that kind. But it also said that if you're going to do something like that, you have to have really tough controls on it, and somebody has to be in charge. Others? Let's see, I'm looking for a young lady right back there. Okay. Told you're going to get the last question. She's coming that way.
Ma'am, I'm an active duty military officer as well as being a graduate student here at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute. And so I've actually had experience of working out in Afghanistan with the State Department. And it obviously is very important, we've discovered, to have that link between the military and the State Department. However, often our soldiers and our diplomats are operating under different rule sets and different chains of command. And I was wondering how that will be addressed, and also how will you address the tour length so that, you know, when a soldier or unit is coming through and they're working, will they have the same person to work through with the State Department? Thank you.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for your service to our country. And Yes, I think the way that we've addressed it, and you're right, there are separate chains of command. They're going to continue to be separate chains of command because the military reports up through the Secretary of Defense to the President in the National Command Authority, and the diplomatic corps reports through me to the President on the other side. But what we found is that we need absolute fusion of our processes in the field. I think both with General Eikenberry and Ambassador Newman in Afghanistan, and before them General Barno and Zal Khalilzad, and now Zal Khalilzad and General Casey in Iraq, what we've done is to see a very great fusion at the center. The ambassador in Iraq or Afghanistan and the three-star in charge in Afghanistan or Iraq see each other all the time, meet all the time, their staffs are always together. I don't think there is much danger of any distance between them. As you go down through the chain, however, I think that's where we need to start to achieve better integration. And it's one reason that I noticed, made the note about the POLADs, that it's been that those were essentially positions with a four-star someplace in the world, when really you want to see political-military integration further and further down the chain. I think another thing that we could really do is, so to speak, more cross-training. You know, I was talking with some people yesterday about the Foreign Service Institute and more work with the National Defense University and with the war colleges, because the continuum between ending conflict, stabilizing a country, and then moving it on to independence is something that we have to be better at doing. And it requires integration of all of our assets, but it also requires integration of our people with the host country. So it's a very complex effort, and I think we will see more of it. You know, again, we've done this before. If you look back at World War II, you'll find that American military and American diplomats worked very, very closely together in the reconstruction of Germany and in getting Germany on its feet. You'll find that they worked very closely in Asia and Japan on the reconstruction. So it is, again, work that we've done before. We, in a sense, lost our muscle tone to do it during the long period of the Cold War, when the international system was, quote, stable in a way that I think required less of this kind of work. But that began to change with the Balkans in the 1990s. It certainly changed with the collapse of the Soviet Union and then with the Balkans in the 1990s. And then it began to change even more rapidly as change has been coming to the Middle East. So I believe that this is something that we will do, and we will do well. And we have to do it well. Because the fact of the matter is that when people say, well, this is hard, and can you imagine a better world, or why do you think there might be a better world, or why do you put so much faith in democracy and so much hope in this particular outcome, I really want to say to them, do you have a better idea? Do you have an alternative? Do you have an alternative to well-governed democratic states that are responsible in the international system? We've seen the alternative. The alternative's in Afghanistan that isn't governed at all and where Al-Qaeda runs wild. We've seen the alternative in Sudan, where we see the butchering of people that takes place. We've seen the alternative, and we don't like that. And so, like our predecessors did in World War II, we have to focus all of our energies on making this happen. And I just want to close by saying, you know, in 1989, I was lucky enough to be here, as President DeGioia said. I was the Soviet specialist at the end of the Cold War in the White House. It really doesn't get much better than that. And I got to participate in the liberation of Eastern Europe and the unification of Germany and eventually the peaceful breakup of the Soviet Union itself. But in fact, people like me were just harvesting good decisions that had been taken in 1946 and 1947 and 1948. Because if you look back in the post-war period, it didn't look very easy. In 1946 and 1947, Germans were still starving in Europe. In 1946, communists won big minorities in Italy and in France. In 1947, there was civil war in Greece. There was civil conflict in Turkey. In 1948, Czechoslovakia fell to a communist coup. Germany was permanently divided in Berlin. And in 1949, the Soviet Union exploded a nuclear weapon 5 years ahead of schedule, and the Chinese communists won. This wasn't just a kind of minor setback for democracy. These were huge strategic setbacks. And so when I walk into my office, the other portraits that I look at in addition to Jefferson are portraits of George Marshall, but especially Dean Acheson. Because how out of all of that chaos at the end of World War II did they think to construct a collective security organization called NATO? Did they think to press for democracy in Germany and Japan? Did they stay so true to their values that they understood that Europe had always had temporary solutions to its problems? For more than 150 years, France and Germany, everybody wanted them to stop fighting, but they didn't do it. And finally, with democratic values enshrined in Germany and a democratic institution like NATO organizing Europe, nobody can imagine Germany and France fighting again today. And so we've done it before. We can do it. And one day, people are going to look back. Somebody's going to be serving in the White House. And they'll look back and they'll say, you know, I'm really glad that America stayed committed to those values. I'm really glad that America worked with its partners around the world to promote those values. Because there's a peaceful and prosperous and democratic Middle East, and the world is forever changed. Thank you.